You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello, you are now listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. I would like to start today's show by acknowledging that today we are coming to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation. I would like to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Slums in some metropolitan centres are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush.
The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
Amy is a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
And that's right. You're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence with me, Amy. Happy to be here for another week. I'm really excited to let you all know that the show is now available on Spotify and iTunes. I know, boo, they're evil corporate platforms, but I've had some feedback that the RSS system and going to the website is a bit of an accessibility issue for some people. So this is the main reason why I'm on there. I don't believe you'll get any Spotify ads or iTunes ads if you do listen to the podcast through there. And I do encourage you to boycott those platforms, of course, and give the RSS system a go. Today we're going to be talking grassy plains with special guest Adrian from the Grassy Plains Network, and then we're going to be hearing part two of my interview with Permaqueer, which is going to be a very exciting conversation. I will be at the Degrowth Festival this weekend, which is I'm really excited for. I think a few of the guests that have been on this show are going to be there, which is really exciting. And I rode in this morning, caught the train, the V-line, and then rode in. Gotta say, it's really refreshing to ride along the Merri Creek, because I was staying at a friend's in Preston's last night. It's really refreshing to ride along the Merri Creek and see all the beautiful things that are happening along there, rather than where I currently live in Geelong, where it's a haven to the lawns and the white picket fences. I think that's all the news. So we're going to dive straight into our interview with Adrian. Adrian, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Amy. It's great to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show. For the listeners, if it's the first time you've caught this show is called Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. It's all about breaking out of the little boxes that we live in, challenging how we live in the cities and suburbs, and trying to, decolonize in a way, try and move our ecology to be more in line with what should be here and what is more sustainable, rather than focusing so much on aesthetic and even encouraging things like commoning projects where your local food and stuff like that. So today we're talking Grassy Plains because they are in a very dire situation. So maybe we'll start with who the Grassy Plains Network is.
Yeah, sure. It's we started about 5 years ago. We came out of a conference, a group of community members, academics, ecologists, all concerned about the, dire state of native grasslands in Victoria. For a couple of years, we were very generously funded by a philanthropist, and then we're part of the Victorian National Parks Association, which has been around for about 70 years or so. So we do a lot of advocacy and engagement around native grasslands. So native grasslands, there's like 0.56% of them left. So 1/200th of their the original, you know, huge plains that went from the Yarra River, Birrarung, all the way to Portland and the South Australian border. We've only got like 1/200th of them left. It's about the most endangered ecosystem in Australia, probably.
That's decreased from a number that I heard you give like a year or two ago on a different show.
That's true. That's true. The new I got my hands on some good research from the Arthur Riley Institute, part of CSIRO, and they the latest data 0.56%, and they reckon that's an overestimate. So. Pretty grim.
One of our First Nations presenters here is Uncle Robbie Thorpe, and he has this thing called the Genocide Ecocide Complex. And he says if they didn't care about the genocide, and then what they do care about is ecocide, because if you don't care about ecocide, if you get genocide and ecocide, you get suicide.
It sounds pretty full on, but yes indeed. Well, they did go side by side, didn't they, lot. So the dispossession of First Nations people across Victoria happened at the same time that the pastoralists came in and basically did this giant resource extraction. We had a grass rush before the gold rush.
And now we have a housing rush.
We do indeed, that's right, and that's putting lots of pressure on a lot of the grasslands we have left, because surprisingly a lot of them are actually around the edge of Melbourne and in the western north of Melbourne. Merri Creek catchment would be one.
And it's just interesting because I'm thinking about this as someone who's worked for different councils as a gardener / landscaper. I did get a very good education at Melbourne Polytechnic, where we did also do bush crew work, which was lucky, as I'll get into later. But basically, the issues that I see is there's so many different jurisdictions of who's managing what, whereas probably before colonization, you would have had different nations, different language groups with agreements between each other, very much putting country first. But I think what I'm seeing just in my, since starting this show and before, the reason I started the show as well is that it's always last on the agenda when it comes to the big build or roads and infrastructure. It's always last on the agenda, the agenda, the effect on ecology. And then I notice what tends to happen is that what's left of the remnants, as it's often referred to, becomes like a museum piece.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've heard a lot of council people refer to this as a living museum and so on. But big infrastructure is a problem, you know. Like, I mean, it's we do need big batteries and solar farms and that sort of thing. But so often they land right on top of grassland because it's like empty, quote unquote, vacant land kind of thing, when it's actually occupied by, you know, critically endangered ecosystem. It's
And you know. I think it's because they just view Australia as just this really big, endless continent where they can just keep building. And I've had people on the show, an academic, Anitra Nelson, who wrote a book called Small is Necessary, Shared Living on a Shared Planet. And it was basically about how our housing and our ways of living need to be more sustainable, and they need to be smaller, and we need to share a lot more. We need economies of sharing. I think this is such a profitable, this is such a big profit motive in the fact that you can just keep building these very 1950s Menzies style suburbs that are just sprawling. And it's, I've even seen on my local registered Aboriginal party's website, the Wadawurrung traditional owners, traditional owners, and how they're one of their major concerns is urban sprawl. I guess we've gotten into this question a bit, but I mean, let's dive a little bit more into why they're important.
Okay. Well, why are grasslands important? Hell, just because they're our local identity. They're what Australia is or was before colonial settlement landed on it. They provide the urban resilience, I suppose. If you want to think about it in human-centric terms, it's like grasslands filter the water, they create all the insect stuff that helps pollinate crops and the whole sustainability thing. It's They often protect areas from sea level rise and so on, coastal grasslands, coastal ecosystems, and grasslands along our estuarine and river systems and so on too.
And so it's an interconnected holistic system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a beautiful, I've recommended it on the show before, but I think people need to watch it because it was so well done. The Australian Wild Odyssey. It was on ABC iView. It follows water all the way from the top of the continent all the way to the bottom and all the conservation efforts along the way. And it shows you how everything is interconnected above and below ground. And it's something that is catching up with people in the climate crisis. Dystopian levels in other parts of the world where there are sinkholes emerging where they've drained all the water and they haven't looked after the land.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we are very tree-focused, I suppose. Like people need to learn to see grasslands. So you're often they're perceived at like 90 kilometres an hour building along the freeway or something as this brown, vacant fire trap full of snakes or something What I spend a lot of time doing is getting people out into a grassland and going, oh, look, there's a daisy, there's an orchid. So between the tussocks of grass, all the biodiversity that's in there, it's not actually the grass. It's the stuff between the grass that's the real focus.
And going back to that documentary, there was a bit with an entomologist. Is that the insect person? Entomologist? I remember. Yes. But yeah. And she was wandering through native grasslands with a net doing little grid system, like analyzing what lives there. And she really drew attention to the incredible, invisible biodiversity of insect life, which I imagine grasslands are hugely important for.
Absolutely. Someone was out at Little River the other day and took a photo, a couple of years ago, took a photo of a moth.
Yeah.
Put it on iNaturalist. Turned out it hadn't been seen since 1919.
Wow.
So it's just like, okay, there you go. You never know what's out there.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing.
And so obviously one of the concerns would be extinction of species, and then there's the environmental impacts, as you mentioned. But what are some other concerns that you've noticed or that you've come up with?
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose it's lack of protection would be the big one. So a lot of our grasslands, like they're officially protected. They're listed under the federal and state nature laws and so on, the EPBC Act and FFG Act. But people just clear them anyway. Mm. And it's often, you were saying before, about the number of different owners and so on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, cemetery trusts, railway lines, road authorities, farmers, local council, etc. So it can be really hard to get these environmental crimes people made responsible for them. And we've had a couple of really big cases just in the last few years where one where like a 40 hectare conservation area was covered in asbestos contaminated fill by like an operation must have taken weeks and 1,000 trucks kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's still dragging through the various courts and so on. But the state government had a responsibility to tell the federal government, and it was actually me who told the federal government, like a month after it had happened. It was what's going on? Things like that. We had another one, a landowner just cleared 40... Another.
I reported on that last year.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, that was astounding because, like, we took drone video footage of it going on and sent it to everyone. 40 hectares.
Yeah.
And no one stopped it. They just let it continue. So that sort of thing happens. And it's often it's down to local councils and they just don't have the resources. So there's, like, one compliance officer or two compliance officers for a huge area, and there's rubbish dumping and illegal dog fighting and God knows what else that they've got to deal with.
We're about to go to a break, but before we do, this relates to a story I was covering last year, which is a mine being built on the Mitchell River in Gippsland. They want to build a tailing dam mine to do a open sand mineral sands mine, which in regional Victoria has wreaked havoc on environment and regional communities. There's going to be dust coming off this mine that contains silica, thorium, and uranium, and these previous projects have completely devastated regional communities and country. And of course, the tailings dam is banned in many parts of the world, but not here. And basically, they just keep mounding earth and building a dam full of toxic waste. And this will flow, if this something goes wrong after they build it, it will flow into the Mary Chains Pond, like the greater Gippsland Lakes, and cause irreversible harm to more endangered ecosystems. And the thing that I learned following this, by the way, folks, I got an update from that crew. The test pit has gone ahead and the local registered Aboriginal party has approved a cultural heritage management plan of the test pit. So that's where we're at this stage. The community is fighting back and the Greens have got 3,500 signatures against the mine and they have to do another environmental effects statement. But the thing that I've learned following this is that in Victoria's environmental laws they have still got a long way to go before they're genuinely protecting environment. I think it was the Environmental and Biodiversity Conservation Act. It seems to rely on the goodwill of people to actually be enforced. So after the break, we're going to talk a bit about compliance and maybe some of your views in this area, because it seems to me that the story, at least locally in Victoria, is that people just keep walking away with environmental destruction.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
Come to the Degrowth Festival on Sunday the 22nd of March from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. Building community and resilience. Let's create the world we want by practicing it now together. Sing, dance, picnic under the trees, and check out the dozens of stalls, workshops and talks. The 2026 Degrowth Festival, Curtin Square, Carlton. Search for Degrowth Festival 2026 on Humanitix for more details and to register. The Degrowth Festival is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM or on the website at 3cr.org.au or on the Community Radio Plus app. I'm in the studio today with Adrian from the Grassy Plains Network. We were just talking about the Grassy Plains and the situation with them. We're now going to move on to compliance. And basically, it seems like the property developers seem to get away with a lot at the moment. Are Grassy Plains mostly affected by property developers at the moment?
Property developers are a big one, yes. It's that and big infrastructure and I suppose private landholders too, who are doing grazing and stuff. But no, property developers, especially because it's around the edge of the city and so on, like where we've got a lot of our remnant grassland left. So yes, they try everything. And the worst one is, I suppose, clearing by neglect in a way. So you just like do not do – grasslands need to be looked after. Mm. Like you have to get rid of their biomass. You have to get rid of all the dead thatch and open them up and so on so light and water can get to the soil. And if you don't have any grazing or any burning, if you just let them go, the weeds get in there, the whole system can collapse really quite easily. So and it's one of the real problems with colonial dispossession of the First Nations people is we lost all of that management.
And of course the continued destruction is so traumatizing for them because it's country, it's sacred.
Absolutely. Yeah. So developers, yes, they're certainly leading the charge in the loss of grasslands one way or another.
Mm.
Not a lot gets done to, like, there are rules and regulations, you know, there are plenty of those.
Yeah.
But it's just like who's doing the policing and so on. We had a really good positive outcome last year. The Office of the Conservation Regulator, they're a Victorian part of the Environment Department, basically, who administer the Wildlife Act, compliance with the Wildlife Act and so on.
Okay.
And Power Corps, who just big power company that had been there. They pinged them for 30 instances of roadside grassland damage across Western Victoria.
Wow.
Which is fantastic because this is the first time, actually literally the first time a state institution by themselves had come down on an organisation to say you're wrecking grasslands and you've got to pay.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that when it comes to the big companies and this stuff, at least for now, we really do need someone to come down hard on them, to slow them down, to stop them. I think there's a lot of work to come in terms of restoration and restoring and looking after things. But there's got to be something so they can't just wave their hands over it and just pass the environmental stuff off. Like, you know, I'm sure people have seen that show Utopia, where he's like, you know, going out there and like finding out that, you know, they're about to destroy something really important and they're just like talking around it and just like going straight ahead and just destroying whatever it is. And
absolutely. The whole system set up to allow you to clear stuff, isn't it? So you can offset stuff and protect something else elsewhere.
So what are some of the acts? And I think I was just talking to you in the break about the EPA. The EPA has been a bit notorious in Victoria there has been some improvement. I think the Greens are fighting for more improvement. Where do you sit on where this all is at the moment?
Yeah, okay. So, well, the EPA, again, probably one of those organisations that in many ways means well but doesn't have the capacity, I reckon, at least in grassland punishment terms, as it were. Office of Conservation Regulator, we've got the Melbourne Strategic Assessment Team. That's a complicated space.
Yeah.
And then there are councils, are the main regulators.
Yeah.
All of the and they regulate things under the Planning and Environment Act, and that which is really it's the Planning Act with a bit of environment chucked in there.
Yeah.
Or the Environment Removable Act, perhaps. But there are penalties under that, but they're just insufficient. Often for these developers, clearing a large tract of grassland will, if they do end up in front of court, they might pay a couple of $100,000 in fine.
Mm.
But the land, they spent $15 million buying the land, so it's just it's a small fraction of the total cost. So they just factor it in into their expenses, really. It's business as usual.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, I suppose, is that business as usual isn't working. So the Victorian State of the Environment report that comes out every 5 years, and the last one basically said most is sort of, and the environment is pretty stable, like, you know, heathlands, forests or whatever, like not ideal, but grasslands and wetlands are still in decline, and we've been knowing that grasslands have been in decline since, you know, the 1970s, so when the first sort of big research programs were done on it. And it's still going down,
Well, that was the thing with the mines all across Victoria, all these regional mines where they don't have to pay, I forget what the term is, but the damage that you do, there's like a fine for it, and the cleanup will be like millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars of restoration and cleanup to try and bring back what was there. And the fine that they waive if they choose not to do that is just like ridiculous. It's pennies. Like it's like if it's $100 million, it's only $1 million, which is like chump change to them. Like, of course, will they pay for the restoration to like do it properly, or will they just pay that small fine?
Yes, absolutely. and it would be, it's such an easy thing to fix. You just raise the rate of the fine, you know.
Yeah.
It's like
to cover the costs of repairing what they did.
Yeah.
And then they won't do it.
That's right. And also, I suppose, we need money put into, like, the infrastructure for restoration and so on. So we have a talk about this a lot, the need for seed production areas and so on. So like large farms, basically, that are just there to produce seeds so that we can do large-scale restoration. So because you have to like make grasslands as well as protect the existing ones to actually reverse the trend.
Yeah.
And the government has put no money into this area for many years. Now they're starting to. There are a couple of the First Nations groups have funding for seed production areas and so on, but it's still, there needs to be a much larger statewide focus on nationwide focus.
Yeah, and that can be really good because sometimes those fundings go to the RAPs, and I know RAPs are complicated and there's a lot of criticisms of things, but one of the things I do think they do is they do employ local mob in like a lot of that stuff, like rangering and things like that, and it's like shown to be really good for mob in terms of helping them in all kinds of ways, working on country. And that's the thing I want to move into and bring my perspective to this as a worker from gardening and landscaping who ended up doing a lot of bush crew work, and they were lucky to have me, I'm going to be honest, because I had been trained in bush crew work and I had done stuff with volunteering as part of my TAFE training with Merri Creek Management Community, who probably have the best standard in my view from what I've seen of it. But what they were doing was putting, what I've seen is this, I've seen a mass amount of councils or whoever's managing it just go on the cheap. It doesn't matter if there is if something's been told, like it's like it has to be managed to this level and this standard, it gets ignored. They put unqualified workers, a couple of blokes with some knapsacks and whippersnippers, and off they go. I've worked on sites many, many times where we've been doing the lawns next to indigenous vegetation, and we weren't told to do the indigenous vegetation, and then a year or two down the track, we find out that entire time we were supposed to be doing it, they just forgot, quote-unquote, to tell us, and now someone's come around and complained, and now they're like, oh, you guys are doing it. And so then what looked like to me, because I've seen the costs and billings of some of these sites, tens of thousands of dollars to build, to plant out, to look after, that was the initial landscaping job for those sites, I've seen that be completely undone by just ignoring it and not sending anyone to manage it. So we come in and we basically have to start it from scratch, but they don't pay us to do the landscaping job again. So all we do is end up just pretty much spraying down all the invasive species, and then what's left is nothing because the invasive species have wiped out the tens of thousands of dollars worth of plants and landscaping. And yeah, the other thing I see is that you have this complicated system. So say you got council, right? You've got council, they've been told they've got to manage this, right? Maybe it's something from the Melbourne Strategic Assessment, maybe it's something else. They've got to manage it, and then it goes out to bidding, to contractors. Now, the council will make a decision over which sites deserve more attention in which areas. So the poorer areas, in my experience, particularly when I worked in Hume City Council, poor areas, they have a star rating. So this company does to a 5-star job, this company does to 3-star, etc. So when I was doing it, I was on the company that did 5-star job. And so we did things, you know, pretty well. I wouldn't say it's the best standard, but we did things pretty well. And then Broadmeadows had like the low star job, and Broadmeadows was a mess. They didn't do anything. And it was just like awful. So then what I see is that I see these weird carbon offset sites where they just put a whole bunch of like river red gums and then just let them go way too dense. I've seen so many instances of just, and I know because I've investigated, I've asked questions at work, I know that there has been like a metric or something that they're actually supposed to be working towards, but they're not complying with it. And I've seen it time and time again.
It's a difficult space, isn't it? It really is. Like most of these things, if it's worth doing well because there are costs further down the track that come back to bite you, really. Speaking of Merri Creek Management Committee, you know, like one of the reasons they're being so great is that they've had planners or environmental planners in their team, like having like the big picture view of it, because so much of the trouble comes when urban areas are first conceived and the land is set aside for green space and for housing and for industry and so on, and there's no connectivity necessarily for it. Like two green patches could be connected to each other, but aren't. Just basic things like that happen, and like with a good planning, you can get in there right at the start of the trouble, as it were, and try and make sure that large-scale problems don't occur. We need more green planners.
And we need more green jobs. So this is what I've been saying on a different show, which is like a workers' show. I'm advocating that we should start talking about jobs in working with plants, looking after country, because these are the best carbon scrubbers we've got. These are the things that are going to like be the thing that protects us from climate catastrophe. You're talking about how water is moving through the environment. You know, when you upset river systems, when you overload them with stormwater during massive rain events, of course they're going to flood. Of course people's houses are going to sink into those rivers. So for me, they're always talking about jobs in construction, jobs in like all these sort of profitable areas, but we need investment in jobs that are actually going to save us from the climate collapse.
Absolutely. And we see that a lot on our, we do a lot of tours, take people out to grasslands to raise awareness and so on. We get a lot of people from bush workers and that sort of thing come along because they've done their training, but they don't necessarily know grasslands really well.
And it's so hard.
It's really hard, yeah.
Grasses are like the hardest thing to identify.
They are. They're really out with your microscope. Yeah, that's it. In the field.
Yeah. So we're qualified technicians. We are we study this. We are actually experts. We are the equivalent of an electrician who knows a lot. Potentially, we are even more knowledgeable with how complex nature can get.
Absolutely. But there often isn't a good career structure for it. Like you just do a lot of spraying or that sort of thing. And then where do you go from there kind of stuff? So
many young people, so much diversity in TAFE to see it just completely die in the industry because people get so disheartened.
Yes, that's right. So, yeah, much better structure and all of that and more of it too. Yeah,
because there's actually a workforce in the waiting, There's so many young people who want to work outdoors and with the environment, and we need investment.
Absolutely.
So we're going to finish up now, and I thought we could talk a little bit about how people can get involved and support the Grassy Plains Network. So you go head away, off you go.
Well, fantastic. Just go to Grassy Plains Network website, hey, and join us through that. That's the best way. That way you get the newsletter, you get all the good news and the bad news kind of thing. The Victorian National Parks Association is our host organisation. So, contact them. We have a lot of, it'll be spring frenzy. We've got a forum with the Australian Association of Bush Regenerators coming up on the 8th of May.
Yeah.
So the AABR is another good way to connect through to us.
Yeah.
And in spring we've got a festival, the Spring Fling Grassland Festival, which is out in St Albans, and that'll be a great event
too. Ah, amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, Adrian.
Well, thank you for being here, Amy.
We're now going to go to Urban Wasteland Survival Guide segment. We'll be back after this with Permaqueer. Keep listening to 3CR. Welcome to this episode's edition of Urban Wasteland Survival Guide, your guide to surviving it out there in the urban wastes. This week, inspired by our permaculture talk with Permaqueer, firstly is to direct you to Local Food Connections, that beautiful show that's still going on a Sunday, which is all about permaculture and ways that you can start learning how to grow your own food. I particularly recommend any of Anne's conversations with people discussing urban foraging. Not only is urban foraging a great way to empower yourself to learn about the food that's growing readily available for you in your weedy garden or in your local council area, provided you've checked for dangers such as herbicides and toxic metals. Not only does urban foraging empower you to find your own food out there in the urban wastes, learn to identify plants and help you find ways to feed yourself in this cost of living crisis for free, but you can do what Anne taught me back on that show, which is grabbing the seeds from those weeds and then chucking them in your garden or in your pots. You know, the thing about the fruit and vegetables that we get from the supermarket is they take weeks to grow. In fact, many of the weeds that are out there are more nutritious than the food you're getting from the supermarket, and you're reducing your carbon footprint by not relying on destructive farming practices. I recommend checking out Anne's recent interview with Jack Adams from Who Gives a Fork and Food Not Bombs with Willow, former guest of this show, Mitch and Sasha, and a bit of a local favorite for urban foraging, Adam Grubb. And in fact, I recommend his book, The Weed Forager's Handbook, A Guide to Edible and Medicinal Weeds in Australia. And that is written with his partner, Annie Razor-Rowland. And if you want to push your herbalism skills and your knowledge of many of the weeds that pop up in your garden, I would also recommend Grow Your Own Herbal Remedies by Penny Woodward. Both of these are great starting points for feeding yourself and nutrition, and it gives you great advice on doing it safely. And welcome back. That was the Urban Wasteland Survival Guide. We are now going to hear the second part of my interview with Guy and Toad from Permaqueer. We begin chatting about their incredible, incredible event last year, Permaculture is Political. I cannot recommend enough going onto YouTube and looking up Permaqueer. That's all one word, Permaqueer, and listen back to Permaculture is Political. Incredible talks, which you're about to hear about in just a moment. I have one recommendation for you, which is they have an urban foraging talk, which, you know, we're just talking about urban foraging a bit, and it's called The Art of Societal Foraging by Maya Raymond. Okay, so let's go to that interview with Permaqueer.
Thank you. Thank you. We had such a great time putting that on that event. It's kind of, you know, our dream job is we get to talk to a bunch of baddies about the incredible work they do in the world. It's a pleasure. And, you know, it was a big fundraiser for a couple of Palestinian organizations as well as some local First Nations orgs. I think one of my favorite, like, the thing that, something that really made me reflect on, like, the, you know, the bush foods industrial complex that we have here in so-called Australia. Zena Cumston really spoke in depth about that. I think it's now less than 1% of income from the bush foods industry actually goes towards First Nations people. And what does it actually mean, particularly like when we're experiencing things like, you know, oncoming climate catastrophe, our food systems, we really should be pivoting more towards traditional, like indigenous foods here. And how does that happen without then just engaging in a further neocolonialism? That was a really big ooh moment. Like, how do you bring in indigenous foods in a way that doesn't further colonize all the work that you're trying to do? That was a really fantastic one. Everyone kind of brought something really, I mean, it's cheesy to say, but everyone brought in something really unique. And I think that that's what we really tried to focus on in the whole, the back end things of this whole queering, is how do we build this narrative of social change from all these different voices. Did you want to throw something into that?
I also just wanted to add, for our 3CR listeners, there was a fantastic talk by Farid, I hope I've got the name right, Tamala, because we've been the only media voice for Palestine since the 70s, and we've been targeted a lot by different entities for voicing Palestinians. So that was another brilliant one, and that was about Ba'ali farming, traditionally.
Yeah, Farid. Fareed's was absolutely fantastic, and it was a real joy, you know. And I also want to put a just a deep love to our regenerative community and network that, like, you know, how this, these speakers, these topics came out was through the whole network of relationship, of trust, of understanding. And that's not to say that we, you know, there was a lot of people that we didn't know personally in that, but, you know, regenerative ways of being are based off of stable relationships. They're based off of continued ethic and value that was consistent across all of these speakers, which was really beautiful. And I think if I was, it's impossible to say which were my favorites, but I would highly recommend people listening to any of the First Nation, all of them generally, but also the First Nations presentations. I think, you know, colonialism is always a trend between everything that we talk about, but if I'm completely honest, we all know that the solution is beyond colonialism. Mm. And so listening to these voices that have contextualized their solutions within this current moment, that is our best pathway to liberation. And, you know, permaculture is in and of itself a way that we can establish and remember and build that practice of relationship with place. But there are many cultures and communities across the world that never lost that. Mm. And it's up to our brokering of relationships with them and understanding and learning from them that we'll be able to step into these more equitable regenerative food systems. And so I'd highly recommend listening to all of the First Nations speakers. It's just absolutely beautiful historical storytellings of the gods of Palestine, of all these different beautiful, you know, Tyson's one about all the signals and
yeah, that the snakes,
the echidna sex walk sort of thing. He's so hilarious. He's so brilliant, and he's so profound in how he shares. And that was consistent across a lot of them. And then also, you know, for people who feel like maybe they need more of a, I don't know, a Western justified perspective, there's also some really amazing speakers from governmental roles, such as Deepa, who takes a sort of more internal, you know, because community approaches are also fraught. We all know that, and we love it. And to be part of community is to be inconvenienced. Mm. And so I think this series approaches this, you know, community food systems from many different angles, so that we can sort of understand the challenges, the limitations, and the dreams and the desires of how we can move forward together. So yeah, a few of those in there that I'd definitely recommend.
Yeah, and we kind of spoken a little bit about what the talks we've had, but I guess in a very queer way, coming at it from the back end to the front.
Yeah.
The reason we actually put this on was because we kept, like, we were just these kind of, you know, hornet kicking queers in permaculture who were like talking about decolonizing and things. And, you know, on the weekly, we get odd emails with Bible verses or, you know, all the things. But one of the consistent things that we kept getting was permaculture isn't political. Mm. And even Bill Mollison was famous for saying that, even though, you know, he was out in the streets protesting for Indigenous rights back in the day. He's a complex man. And I think that we all need to just, like, for better and for worse, when we, you know, make heroes out of individuals, we collapse their complexity of full humans. I've definitely seen that happen with Bill, for the good that he's done and also the not great things. Mm. But yeah, so we kept hearing permaculture isn't political. But of course, any kind of land management practice that comes from systems thinking, observations of First Nations people, different kind of schools of sciences that practices land management on stolen country, who gets access to food, who gets access to land, all of these things are deeply political. And so, like, part of our marketing was that we had permaculture isn't political with the NT crossed out, because we were just so tired of hearing, oh, permaculture isn't political, why are you trying to make it political? Whereas, and we wanted to showcase, like, what does permaculture, what are the critiques that people have for permaculture from different marginalized perspectives, but also the ways in which different communities who are on the fringes have taken regen ag, permaculture, agroecology, these other practices and what they've managed to do and innovate and push forward outside of just white middle-class backyards. Mm. And turns out these practices can be really political, really radical, really community-centered around like food justice and climate justice and First Nations justice. It's just they don't get the screen time or the, you know, the show time that teaching people how to grow carrots next to tomatoes in your little private backyard gets. Mm. That's great. I love that. But, you know, if we have these ethics around earth care, people care, and fair share, those become deeply political things. Mm. I mean, it's just the, you know, the tension sometimes between the design philosophy and practice and those ethics and the movement, which is made up of people. Mm. And all of that complexity there. Talking about like the dreamings of what permaculture can look like outside of these spaces.
Yeah.
I was really lucky to be one of the youth ambassadors for Permaculture Australia to the International Perma Youth Convergence in Timor-Leste to like kind of learn about what youth-led permaculture is happening over there. And I just want to like, outside of, you know, the very kind of global north bubble or global minority bubble, what permaculture can look like can be radical.
Hmm.
Like I was seeing people who were using, you know, post-violent occupation, were using permaculture just as a framework just to kind of support their own indigenous practices, engage in recharging the water table to bring back like 700 springs, which was preventing a lot of conflict, like, and wild event, amazing, complex, you know, full spectrum, and I can't get into it at this moment. But one of the things that was really, really big to hear, it was a talk by the president of Timor-Leste who came to the event, and he was talking about how with the oncoming climate catastrophes, the global north isn't coming to save us. So how do we actually use all these different practices, permaculture, agroecology, our traditional indigenous practices, to kind of build ourselves in a way that makes us resilient for the future? And I think that there's that element as well, like the kind of, it's not disaster, well, it's kind of disaster preparedness permaculture, and that like community organizing is disaster preparedness. Permaculture can be disaster preparedness. And these kinds of, like when we saw, like when the COVID lockdowns happened, what we thought was really kind of just sweet and friendly and like lovely actually meant that we built meaningful relationships with our neighbors and around food sovereignty and community organizing and these dumpster diving redistribution networks that was led by a woman that we lived with. And so these practices that seem really sweet, it's like, how do we actually understand them to be something that can protect us into the future? And that, you know, it's better to prepare for something rather than in the collapse and in the ruins, try to pull ourselves together. There was a very long-winded way of saying in which what they're doing in Timor-Leste, that's youth-led, is far more radical than what I'm seeing a lot of the times here.
Yeah.
In that people who, out of necessity, are leading the way. Innovation is, you know, is on the edge. And that's one of those queer principles as well of like, you know, in permaculture, we have that principle of use the edge and value the marginal. I don't love that language of use the edge. But by being in relationship with our edge, innovation is always happens at the edge. Mm-hmm. And how do we design our systems to be in mutual like reciprocity with those on the edge?
Hmm. I have a segment called Urban Wasteland Survival Guide, where every week I will have like a zine or some, you know, just some tips on foraging or something like that. And a lot of inspiration comes from the Global South. Because, as you said, out of necessity, people in the Global South have to develop ways to survive. And there are technologies, low-tech technologies in particular, that are coming out that are being used extensively in the Global South. And the reasons are not great why it's happening, but they're also quite amazing technologies like solar cookers or biofilters for filtering water. It's like there is a resilience being built out of in the Global South because they are actually in the front lines of this.
I see permaculture where it's being led by people in the global majority of Global South, but I have to speak that devil into the room as well. I also see permacolonialism, which is where, you know, generally white affluent people go and do a lot of white saviorism. It's not about building relationships or reciprocity. It's about going in and teaching them how to do something whereas permaculture can be shared in ways that uplifts local leaders to kind of support their own traditional ways of being. It can be really great or really terrible.
I just want to add one thing in the end of that permaculture is political, and that's also about sort of what one of the many intentions that we had for that, you know, a large driving force of this permaqueer project is to, as we keep coming back to, is creating agency or having more agency. And we thought a lot about, yeah, we want to present these ideas, but really what we want is engagement. What we want is organizing. What we want is for these amazing, you know, case studies or ideas or different food solutions to naturalize into all of the viewers' communities and what that looks like. And we know change is slow and progressive and unfolds in a lot of ways, but in the same regenerative ethic, every time we do an event like that, we constantly reflect on, you know, what actual impact, what relationship, what resource, how is this actually showing up in our communities? And I think, you know, as beautiful and as wonderful as all the speakers are and everything, there's a just tragic reality of the state of our climate, of the state of our food system, of the state of our water. You know, the announcements about the global water shortage that we now have, that we know we have, what we are stepping into, we have never seen before. And I think, you know, it's really beautiful to hear the urban wasteland and disaster preparedness. And also we urge all listeners to really inform yourself about what urban risks are, what yes. resilience looks like, because, you know, we're in a truly are in a concrete wasteland that is all of the food, the resources that come in and out are deeply monitored through this mechanism of capitalism, and that needs to change, and you are at direct risk as we move forward. And, you know, acknowledging that it is the global minority, the global north, you know, definitely not in the same kinds of risks as we do have in the global south, but this is all connected, and we need this action to be mobilized in our communities. And so I also feel compelled to acknowledge, like, the funds and resources. We talk about, you know, how do we do these things and how does this operate. We had the privilege of applying for a charity pot fund for Lush, the cosmetics company that supports a lot of regenerative initiatives, that funded us to be able to produce this for the fundraiser, for everything that came along. And that is something that we're committed to paying forward as well. And so in the same vein of what does this look like in your community, it's an open invitation. If some of these ideas, they spark interest in you, or you want to do something about it, please reach out to us. Please have a chat. You know, this is so important, and we love exploring what this expression looks like in many different contexts, and genuinely want to support people doing that. And that's how we've tried to position ourselves to be capable of helping and supporting and creating resources around that. So the permaculture's political never ends, and we roll on. Yeah,
that's amazing. Thank you. You both have such beautiful way of expressing things, and I really love it.
You are what you eat, and you are what you eat, and you're even.
Local Food Connections interviews with food producers, backyard growers, and urban farmers. Join us every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio 855 on your AM dial, on 3CR Digital Radio, and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. Local Food Connections, a show about the importance of local food in sustainable communities.
Here we go from dust to dust. You gotta just trust that upper crust, then maintain that good terrain from whence you came.
And you're listening to 3CR's Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. We've just been in the middle of hearing part two of Permaqueer's conversation with myself. Where, if you caught the last episode, you would have heard that they're doing an amazing course right now called Queer Regenerative Designs. Now, while I interviewed them a bit too late for you to hear about how to join the course as a participant. You will hear in this how you can follow along, but also this is a course that they will be doing again and again in the future. So don't worry if this course sounds amazing to you. There will be opportunities for you to engage in this and take this course later down the track. And yeah, so let's go to part two now. And yeah, I hope you enjoy. We talk about the Queer Regenerative Design course and we talk about mutual aid.
Yeah, so we, after kind of years of doing this work, and just kind of having that back end thought of like, how do we, like, basically the model in which we do a lot of our community organizing that we spoke a bit about briefly, me and rather systems thinking, Guy, particularly focused on self-determination, and just have kind of put together this lovely little short course called Queer Regenerative Design, in which kind of mirrors, not mirrors, kind of puts together a lot of our queer theory, trauma-informed design, permaculture. There's a lot of lovely little things in there. I'm just kind of going off on things, but Guy might be able to speak to it more eloquently than what I'm able to in this moment.
Yeah.
Thanks, Toad. Yeah, I mean, this is a weird little beautiful, ugly child of all of our work. You know, we were teaching permaculture design and then all of these things like kept on coming up that didn't really fit, you know, they didn't really fit in the curriculum, or, you know, that was like, what is that, you know, and people kept on asking what is that. And so we made a note of it, and after over 5 years of engaging communities all across the world, this is an expression of all of those questions of what is that, and then asking that question to the next community and the next community. And so it's aggregated between the desires of what regeneration looks like in community. And this, it's bizarre. There's, you know, while it's been informed by permaculture, it's entirely developed in its own way. And last year we had this amazing privilege to work alongside Social Enterprise Australia. This queer regenerative design offering has been solely just for individuals and community, but we applied this to social enterprises all across Australia and asked them at that level of systems influence, of community influence, of, you know, resources, of all that, what does it look like for you? And so that's re-informed some of the questions that we're asking moving forward. So this is an 8-week online course. We do have scholarships for it, so, you know, finance is not a barrier. However, if you can afford, we do urge that people do pay along for that. That being said, it's not a barrier. And we meet with a community of like-minded regenerative thinkers, and we just explore all of the questions, all of the frameworks, and we ask, what does it look like in your context? How do you feel about this? What is sticky? What is not sticky? And so what you'll get out of it, I cannot tell you. You're welcome to take a look at our website for what other people have gotten out of it. And yeah, it's probably our favorite program because it's really intimate. It is not, you know, it's not this big show of organizations or whatever. It's community to community and exploring questions that we don't necessarily get to ask a lot. Yeah. We'll pass back to you, Toad, if there's anything else you want to say.
Thank you. I was just trying to in my brain, but like, how would I succinctly describe this? And I guess it would be for anyone who is wanting to engage in some kind of change making, like positive regenerative change making. How do we learn from ecosystems, systems thinking, and other communities to make change without replicating the systems of violence that we're trying to undo? That would be my little tagline.
No notes.
So if people hear about this after the event starts, because it starts next Monday, are they able to jump in as the course progresses through to April?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've got our online recorded version of it.
Ah, beautiful.
It is like an intimate environment.
Yeah.
So we may potentially offer just the online recorded version of it, just because of the sanctity of that group. However, we will, you know, all the people that are coming along, will ask them to see how they feel about it.
Yeah.
If we do get a lot of numbers as well, we'll I'll put a little waitlist function on the website. If we get a bunch of people, we'll just run a concordant one. We can definitely do that.
So it's running Monday 23rd of February to Monday, 13th of April. What is trauma-informed design? I find that very interesting. I'm someone who lives with complex trauma and dissociation, so I just find that personally quite interesting.
No, I can absolutely speak to that. I'm also someone with a diagnosis of complex PTSD. So a lot of it is, like, we use a lot of the window tolerance model.
Okay, yeah.
Which, you know, has strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
But a lot of the idea is, how do we design systems that allow people to come to the edge of the window and to expand the window? Mm. And we understand that when we're within that window of tolerance, it's easier for nervous systems to engage in collaborative, long-term thinking and also question their values. Mm. Whereas when we're outside of the window of tolerance, we're inherently geared towards, it's not impossible, but we're more geared towards short-term, competitive, extractive thinking.
Yeah.
And we're more likely to fall on those extractive tools. So what is our challenge as community organizers and designers to help people, like, structurally come within the window and help people stretch that window?
Hmm.
And to add to that as well, you know, I think in systems thinking, when we're trying to design for systemic change or behavioral change, community change, unless we have a trauma lens on it, the binary of how people should behave gets applied to the entire community. And we see that in people reach for punitive, carceral responses. People don't understand the plethora of different trauma responses. And it reinforces, unless you have a trauma-informed lens to systems design, it just reinforces the same system, because we're projecting how people should respond. And we see it time and time again, where people don't understand diversity, they don't understand difference. We have racist responses, homophobic responses, ableist responses, left, right, and center, exploding everywhere, because there's not that understanding of how diversity and how different lived experiences and the challenges of these systems of violence, how they play out on communities.
Hmm.
Mm.
And if I speak to that a little bit, that's when you start to see, you know, we've all been in very lovely left organizing spaces, for better and for worse. It's when we don't have those trauma-informed approaches that we start to see the, as Guy said, the racist, homophobic, sexist practices being used by, but also being used with progressive language. We start to see the purity politics, the policing, the this, the that, but using the languages and the frameworks of liberation to enact those same systems of violence upon each other. That idea of shifting a boot from one neck to another is liberation.
Hmm.
Lateral violence is not liberation.
No.
No. No.
I love that. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about mutual aid specifically,
yep.
Ecological mutual aid. And yep. I think, you know, as we continue to see these water systems, climate systems, food systems, political systems, all of these things continue to pressure and break down, and, you know, the ways that these breakdowns express will just be a hardening across everything that, you know, supports us. And I think it's a long way to fall from the global north and in his so-called Australia, where, you know, we're so inflated by the ongoing genocide of this land and the extraction of the minerals and the fossil fuel industry and the gas industry that props up the Australian economy and all of the things and the benefits and the privileges that we get to have here. And there's just a reality that is wrong and unsustainable, and also these systems are fracturing. You know, looking at what happened in the food system all across Australia during COVID was a huge example of how fragile this food system is, and that is without the extreme climate conditions that we're currently having. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what explorations of mutual aid look like in our communities. And I put in ecological mutual aid there for a range of reasons, mainly because, you know, we've been talking a lot about where the thought comes from. And I think when we say resources or money or, you know, housing, it's so deeply embedded in the transactional extractive approach of capitalism. That's how we, you know, and when I was talking before about pseudo-sovereignty, we believe we can achieve sovereignty by working and exchanging the tokens that we get for the thing that we need. And thus we've maintained sovereignty in our little what's available to us. And so I've seen a lot of really awesome mutual aid initiatives, and then a lot of ones like actually really limited by the thought that underpins them. And so I think, I'm not sure if you want to add anything more here, but this was more about how do we look to the ways that our environment shares resources, the seasons that we belong to, the flows of water, the flows of soil, and how do we build our mutual aid mechanisms around those realities? And I think once it leads from a principle of country, an ecological principle of our landscape, it's harder to get swept up in the challenges that I've seen in other mutual aid.
Yeah.
Something that just popped into my mind while we were talking about mutual aid as well, and just like you know, the idea that like it's on the fringe or at the edges where like you see the most innovation. I really like, I live on Bundjalung country, but specifically like in Lismore, Ojibwa country, and I have to give a shout out to the mutual aid that I see happening here in response to the community-led structures that have emerged around mutual aid, given post-flood. Like catastrophe, and I don't know how that would fit into your framing guide, but that I just also from that like that queering principle of like that on the edge, yeah, when it has to be community led and like services have often disappeared, I'm always really interested in the structures that emerge organically from community.
I think that sort of often gets the most purist in a way, like not in like a politically purist like we were talking before, but like in the most sort of honest way sometimes when it emerges organically from the community. Not always, but yeah, I always love working with people who, for example, say they're talking about working class issues, but they've never read Marx or anything, so they don't use words like bourgeoisie or proletariat, which is fantastic because it's such a great way to alienate people. But they hit all the marks. Uncle Robbie, you know, he speaks in a way that is just so engaging, but also I've seen so many people when I was involved at Camp Sovereignty walk up there from all walks of life, all kind of backgrounds, and him just walk up and talk to them and suddenly having them doing ceremony and all this stuff, and they just were happening walking by, you know. And I think there's this, I always reflect and think about connection in that way. And I do think organically sometimes out of these communities responding to disaster or an issue in the community, some really great things come about.
You hit something really, really fantastic there about like the idea of the exclusionary nature sometimes of some of our ideology and movements and things. I don't think we necessarily have time to even get into it, but yes. I just like wanted to flag that yeah, moving away from that that purity ideology around these things is how do we actually have conversations with people from different areas of life. I know that a lot of queer people who come from like regional backgrounds who move to NAM and then like don't understand the very academic language in LGBT or queer spaces and like become excluded. And like, once again, from like a systems thinking perspective, are we using purity politics, homogenization? Are we creating hierarchies of power rather than hierarchies of function and responsibility? Like, yeah. I could nerd out about that for an hour, so I will put a pause on myself because that is something I feel strongly about.
Just to close on that mutual aid thing, I think.
Thank you.
Definitely for me, there's a big interest for our next sort of like web series to be around explorations of what mutual aid looks like. And, you know, to speak to what I said before around, you know, perhaps some failures as we're seeing really like, you know, and this is not to diminish what direct mutual aid is, but it is an individual answer to a systemic problem. And I sort of view it in the same way as I view direct action, and that it's really awesome at doing a really targeted thing in this moment, and it's really useful. And also we need to be thinking about what other structural systems and structures are. And I think as we continue to see climate breakdown and you know, the economic impacts of what this is, we need to continuously think about how do we replace these systems that we rely upon in a mutual social smaller structure. And I think there are a lot of people who I hear saying that, but they're really not comfortable trading off accountability for, you know, they will say ACAB to the end of the day, but we won't set up accountability protocols so that we can create, you know, accountability in our own communities. And I think what are those structures that ensure that we have, you know, a smaller version in the global north? We rely on this giant nanny state that we say we hate, but we benefit from so much. And how do we explore and play around with the functions that they serve? Well, what is a community version of that? How do we organize around that? And there are many amazing examples of it. And the more we see those and the more we engage with them, the more stable our communities will be moving forward. And so that will be a big focus for us. And if any of the listeners or yourself, Amy, are interested in what that looks like, we're, you know, please let's continue this discourse and see what emerges. I would love to see a mutual aid sort of web series to build on.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
I'll be uploading the complete interview online. Don't you worry about that. And as a separate podcast, as well as today's episode with what you heard today, and also last week's episode is already up. Sorry, last fortnight's episode is already up. And don't forget that if you've been struggling to listen to the show via the RSS feed or by going to the 3CR website, you can now use those filthy, filthy platforms, iTunes and Spotify, to listen to the show. By the way, you can use the RSS link to listen to the show in those platforms already. You can find out more about Permaqueer's Queer Regenerative Design course and future courses at www.permaqueer.com. You can also follow them on Instagram and YouTube. Don't forget to check out that amazing course, Permaculture is Political, at Permaqueer at YouTube. And please follow this show at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn and on Instagram at 3cr_kill_your_lawn. Stay tuned for Think Again. And see you in the fortnight's time.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.